Well, hello, and thank you for joining me today on Geezers of Gear episode number 221. Today's podcast is brought to you by Stratum Productions. Stratum understands that successful events hinge on flawless execution. With years of experience in the audiovisual industry, Stratum Productions specializes in providing event planners with cutting-edge solutions that seamlessly blend technology and creativity. From intimate boardroom meetings to sprawling conventions, they're committed to delivering experiences that resonate and leave a lasting impact on audiences of all sizes. Stratum Productions truly do stand out above the rest when it comes to event production. To learn more about what Stratum does and who they are as a company, please visit stratumpro.com. And also today, I would like to give an honorable mention to a sort of non-sponsor sponsor. They are a sponsor in that they're a friend of the show and have provided a great service to the industry. So, of course, I'm talking about my favorite coffee company, Coffee Cult, coffee with a K, cult with a K. And you can visit coffeecult.com and order our own Geezer's Grind, which is our own custom blend that was done for us by Coffee Cult. And every purchase of Coffee Cult Geezer's Grind provides a benefit to the industry in that Coffee Cult have graciously given up the proceeds on orders to donate that money to robybackstage.com. I'm sorry, Roby Backstage. There is no .com. And that money then goes to help people in our industry who either are sick, injured, or just in need. And so it goes to a great cause, but it's also an excellent, excellent coffee. And if you want to learn more about Coffee Cult, you can watch a recent episode that we did with Jamie Martis, the CEO and founder of Coffee Cult. Pretty interesting stuff. I learned a lot about coffee and the coffee I'm drinking and why I like it. And so, yeah, you get not only a good feeling in that you've given to a charity that helps our industry, but you also get a great cup of coffee. So please visit coffeecult.com and search for Geezer's Grind, and you will not be dissatisfied. Thank you so much. And we are back here. So I'm looking forward to episode 221 today, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes. But first, a bit of news from the last week or so. First of all, a recent guest on our show, Martin Thomas, lighting designer, production manager, super great guy, got married here in Florida, in Central Florida, over the weekend. And I was supposed to be at his wedding with Missy. And unfortunately, I thought I had to miss it. And then by the time I realized I could probably shuffle my schedule and get myself there, it was too late. They weren't able to change the numbers. And so I had to miss it. So I'm bummed. I saw the pictures. They were great. I've just heard really cool things about the wedding from Howard Ungerleiter, who was there, and Cosmo, who was there. So yeah, I missed it. I'm bummed. And it happens. Also last week, Chauvet opened their new building here in South Florida, and it's a great space. It happens to be right next door to Robe's facility here in South Florida. It's kind of becoming a bit of a Gaza Strip down there with Chauvet, Robe, Martin, I think, still has a facility down here. Elation, of course, has their facility here in South Florida. So, yeah, it's definitely, you know, moving light heaven or hell, depending on which way you want to look at it down here in South Florida. But really nice building. It was a great little party that they had. Albert Chauvet, of course, was there, very proud. And they had a band. They had some food. And also lots and lots of designers. And so I got to see a couple of recent people from the podcast who were on the podcast. Emily, who was just on a few weeks ago, I think, or a couple of weeks ago, she was there. Funny thing, first time I've ever met Emily in person. So I've known her since before COVID, I think, with all the Zoom calls we had and all kinds of stuff, but never met in person. So it was really cool. Cosmo, of course, was there as well. And yeah, some other people too. So Corey was there. So yeah, it was fun. It was cool. Nice opening. What else has happened in the last week or two? Again, some of the guests from our podcast, again, Cosmo, his name keeps popping up, but he won Lighting Designer of the Year at the Live Production Summit, which happened a couple weeks ago, I think in Palm Springs. And so congratulations to Cosmo, very deserving lighting designer, very busy lighting designer, if his acts could stay out there. This is the problem when you have older acts, I guess. They start, they stop, they start, they stop. And so congratulations to Cosmo again. Nobody deserves it more. The guy works his ass off and just a super guy and great designer, very talented. And very close relation to Cosmo, one of his employers, Gateway Productions, won Video Company of the Year. So that was another interesting one. And again, past guest of the show. Lots of other friends won awards there. I think Upstaging might have got Trucking Company. I don't have them in front of me, sorry. And speaking of awards, another friend of the show and recent podcast recording, Rob Koenig from Metallica, of course, won the Nook Schoenfeld Lighting Designer of the Year Parnelli Award at the NAMM show this past weekend. So congratulations to Rob again, deserves it heavily. It was a toughly contested category this year, some really great designers in there. And so for Rob to pull that out was huge. Congratulations. And speaking of the NAMM show, yeah, a lot of people attended, of course, from our industry. I know I saw a lot of booths there, companies from our industry. I think Martin had a booth, Alation did, Chauvet did. Not sure who else, but... of course, ACT, I think it was the first time they showed up with another, I don't think we've announced them yet, but they're coming. PK Sound is coming on as a sponsor. So PK Sound, for the first time showing at a NAMM show with ACT. They were together at LDI, but that's a lighting show more than a sound show, of course. Sorry to the folks from LDI that I said that, but... So anyways, yeah, I mean, I heard it was a pretty good show. It was obviously well attended. NAMM always is. You know, it's a weird show always because you have musicians walking around looking at guitars and drums and everything. There's not, it's a musician show and a music store show more than it is a lighting show or even a professional sound show, although sound is much more closely tied to NAMM than lighting is. Even though as a lighting vendor, I've been going to NAMM since the 90s. I remember doing NAMM show booths, you know, in the early 90s with Trackman and Martin. And so you can't really say it's not a lighting show, but it's really not a lighting show. Like if you have 100,000 attendees at NAMM, there's probably 2,000 people that are interested or 5,000 people that are interested in lighting and the rest are, and I'm sure I'm getting those numbers wrong, so I should just shut up. And then last on shows, ISE is this week in Barcelona. That has been a massively growing show over the last few years, especially. It's always been a good show, but over the last, I think since just before COVID, maybe 2017, 18 is when it really started booming. And now it's just a massive show. I think it's a lot bigger than Plaza, if I'm guessing correctly. Again, I'm probably stepping in poop now and saying the wrong thing, but, it's a great show. It's a big show. I wish I was there, but unfortunately, I have to work and can't run around to trade shows my whole life. So on to today's guest, we have coming up Matt Gaminski. So Matt is a good friend, great guy. Lots to talk about with Matt. Matt is a Boston, Massachusetts native and resident of Astoria, New York. He is a lighting and production designer, lighting director, programmer, and owner of MG Lighting Design. Matt holds a BFA in lighting design from Boston University. Throughout Matt's career, he has worked for various styles and sizes of shows, including theater, dance, industrial, corporate, and concert design and direction. So that's a lot, and I'm looking forward to talking with him. So let's bring on Matt. Matty GLD.
How are you, my friend?
And it's funny that I should call you that because everyone knows that that's your Instagram handle is Matty GLD. And, you know, for the longest time, I thought, why the hell does he call himself Matty Gold? Like, what is that? You know?
You're not the first person.
Why does he call himself Matty Gold? And then finally one day I went, duh, you know? But
well, that goes way back to college. I was like getting ready to graduate from college. And I was like, I need a outside of, you know, my college email address. And I was like, what'll sound cool? And this is way before, you know, you did your first name dot last name. Yeah. And it started on Hotmail. Like, that's how long ago.
Oh my goodness. So, yeah.
Well, but yeah, it just kind of stuck.
I hate to tell you, but my so long ago goes before email. There was no email when my long ago happened. So you're still a youngin'. But no, the whole
thank you.
Yeah, the whole Instagram handle thing is funny because our producer Sarah, of course, tagged the wrong Matt Gaminsky, and I think that's caused...
Well, no, it wasn't even a so, Matt Gaminsky. So, it was just a Gaminsky.
So are you and him dating now or something? Like, now that you've connected on Instagram, what's going on?
I don't know. No, it was actually funny because today, so when the pandemic started, we were actually. Corey Easterbrook, Greek, Rob Koenig, a bunch of people. We formed this kind of Emily Bournes, and we formed kind of a support group via iMessage, and you know, we still have it. We still run it to this day. We bounce ideas off each other.
How do I get in there? I just want to spam LDs all day. So I just want to come in and go, anybody need any, you know, Hog Fours or whatever.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, they know how to get in touch with you. No worries there. No, but no. So today I'm sitting there. I wake up this morning and I get a text from Rob Gibson and in the group chat. And he was like, so I guess I was following the wrong you on Instagram. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, who's this Gaminsky K whatever? He loves to have his shirts off in his Instagram photos. And I was like, that is definitely not me. And
that's hilarious.
We were all laughing about it.
Oh,
it
so really he didn't come after you for like spamming his inbox or anything on
No. But he's like, I'm gonna follow this guy because I'm interested now. I was like, you can unfollow him. He's like, no, this is gonna be a good story.
You wanna hear something funny? So when I first started Gear Source, this is how long ago that was, I had a I think it was an 800 number, or it might have just been my regular phone number. I don't remember, but whatever it was, I think it was 800 whatever. Or it might have been 866 whatever. Anyways, whatever it was, if you dialed like the 800 number instead of the 866 number or whatever, it went to a porn hotline. And you'll never guess who found it and told me was Marcia Stern. Marcia calls me and she goes, Marcel, did you know that if you call 800 instead of 866, you get like this hotline, this sex hotline thing? And I'm like, get the hell out of here. So, of course, I hung up on her and went and tried it. And it's like, you're so hot and all this stuff, right? It's like, whoa.
And you're sitting on there being like, I'm racking up all the minutes on here. My phone bill's going to be through.
Yeah, no kidding. But, yeah, I mean,
it's
funny.
It's so funny that Marcia found it.
Yeah, Marcia found it. There was another one like that. I think it's WestJet in Canada, which is sort of like the JetBlue in Canada, you know, the discount airline or whatever.
We've all flown on it.
And I think it's an 866 number. And if you call 800 instead of 866, you get like a sex line or something. I think it's the exact same problem I had.
Those still exist. That's kind
well,
of
this was a few years ago when I heard about that one, and I went and tried it, and it was real. But yeah, so pretty wild.
Anyway.
So you were in LA. You went to, I'm kind of jealous, you went to the Parnellis, right?
Yeah, I went to NAMM and the Parnellis. It was a lot of fun. It was beautiful. It was so nice to see all the, you know, our industry together celebrating each other. You know, Nicole from Felix, she brought in a table of all women and LGBTQ people. You know, Roby had a table that they brought in a bunch of people. You know, Gateway Studio. I mean, it went on. It was packed. Yeah. Like you couldn't walk 2 feet and without bumping into somebody you know.
Yeah,
and
I
it was
think it's.
just, it was really great.
I think I remember hearing it sold out like a couple months in advance, because I had a few companies reach out to me and say, "Hey, do you need a seat? Because you know it's sold out." And I gotta admit,
have
I've
you been
never
to like...
been to the Parnellis, because every time when it was at LDI, every single year there was always something, like I either had a client dinner that I had to be at, or a you know something, or it was the same night as upstaging's party, or something was always wrong with why I couldn't go to the Parnellis. Plus, I hate wearing a suit, and I didn't really want to dress in a suit. So, you know, and you don't want to go there in jeans and a t-shirt and look like a schmuck, I guess. But
no, but I mean, at the same time, though, it's definitely an experience you have to go to, especially if there's a lifetime award winner that you might or whatnot.
No, I feel bad every year for missing it because I like all the people who get all the awards, right? So,
yeah. I mean, it was amazing watching Rob get his Metallica award. I'm so proud of him. He worked so, so hard on that show.
Of course.
And it was also, you know, there were a few other events that are great with this whole NAMM association that I really like. And, you know, my one issue with LDI is it's so expensive to go to these panels and take these classes. Whereas with NAMM, it's fostering the education, right? So kids can pay, I think it's like $90, and they get access to all the classes throughout NAMM for the week, which is amazing.
Right.
And there's some amazing panels. We had one that I went to is Richard Cadena. He did Electrify the Audience, Not Your Performers. And it was talking about, you know, ground loops and
Richard's and so good how, at that. He's
oh
so good.
God, it was
you see
so
what he's
good.
Doing now with this whole paywall thing? Like he's got all of his, he's got a lot of training and stuff behind the, behind one of the paywall services, which is so cool. I talked to him about it last week.
Listen, man, if he's putting it out there, he should make money on it.
Hell
because
yeah.
And just the way that he educates people, it's so down to earth. It's so much fun. You know, he's like, I'm going to show you videos of people electrocuting themselves. Don't worry, they all survived. And you're like, no way. And he would show it and, you know, you see this guy freeze and shake and smoke comes out of his head. And he's like, but don't worry, he gets up.
Yeah. So. I mean, he was on my podcast telling me those stories. And I remembered, because I was a singer, believe it or not. And I remembered so many times going like this up to the mic and going, you know, and you know.
Well, I mean, the main thing that I found really interesting is, you know, when you're on tour, you hear backline people say, oh, you know, that 60 cycle hum, I'm just gonna throw a ground lift on it, and that's what causes these
of course
problems.
Yeah, well,
and
we never
like
even
that,
threw
that's how you're gonna
back in my day you didn't have like these fancy ground lifts, you just bent the plug off. You know, okay, let's make it a two-pronger, you know.
He would kill you.
Of course he would
that.
Of course he would. You know how many times I've done that in my life, though? Like 1,000. You know, I mean, it's
I mean, we all have.
It's just what you did when you didn't have the stuff, you know. It was always funny, too, because I was always that guy in the band where the band elected me the one to hook up to the 220 supply in the wall or whatever. And so, you know, you'd yell over to the bartender, hey, is this shut off? Yep, it's off. You know,
definitely wasn't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Was that on purpose? No. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. Yeah, me too. But, so did you
I
do
didn't
a
know
course
you were a singer? That's kind of amazing.
You know, it's a funny story, so I'll tell it quickly because it's a funny story.
Yeah,
and I don't think I've ever told this story on the podcast, but I was in sixth grade and I went to church one week. I was Catholic. I went to church with my family, and there was a little ad up saying band looking for a singer at the church. And you know, rock band, play all the latest rock and roll stuff, looking for a singer, audition to audition, call so-and-so or whatever, right? And so I called, and the manager who answered the phone was a Catholic priest, and he was the priest from our church. And he said, yeah, the band rehearses in the basement of the church, but they play at regular gigs. They're a rock band. And so he set
not
me up
like
for an audition.
Not like a Catholic Christian rock, nothing
well,
like
so hang on
rock.
A sec. So I went and auditioned and I got the gig. And so to pay for the rehearsal space, basically, the band every, I can't remember if it was one Saturday a month or every second Saturday or whatever, we played this thing called the Rock Mass. And it was like, I don't know, 8 o'clock at night or something on Saturday nights. And it was packed with like teenagers, right? Just like literally kids that never went to church were all of a sudden packing this church, standing room only. And so this priest's assistant was a German lady, and she was translating these German Christian rock songs. This was prior to Stryper or what was the other big one? Petra. It was prior to all these big Christian rock bands. And so we were playing these really heavy German rock songs translated to English. And, you know, we'd do this once a month or whatever, and that paid for our rehearsal space. And from there, we'd go out and do gigs. We had a song on the radio at one point. And so, but I started out as the singer. And then one day at practice, the priest fires our bass player and hands me a bass guitar and says, here, learn to play. You got 4 weeks till our next gig or whatever, right? So I had to learn like 40 songs on an instrument that I'd never played before. I played a tiny bit of guitar, like just goofing around at home or whatever. But so, yeah, I went and took bass lessons and learned, you know, dong 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 dong, like the most basic bass stuff I could. And then over time, I really got into playing the bass, and I got kind of good at it. And I decided I wanted to be a bass player. I didn't want to be a singer. I was a bass player singer for a long time, and then I started taking gigs as just a bass player and some background vocals, but that was about it. And then I just decided that, you know, I was on the road making $200 a week, but my bar tab was $250. And so I needed a job. So I went and got a job in a music store, and that led to lighting and onward. So that's my life story.
Well, I knew we were kindred spirits. I too play bass. I just haven't had a chance to play in a very long time because I've been on the road. But that's actually how, that's kind of, it was one of those things in high school where I was like, man, I want to, you know, in middle school, we had to do like the band, right? And I was that obnoxious kid that's like, I want to play the snare drum. So literally I would take a snare drum, bring it home and do like just a snare drum, not a full kit, a snare drum. And my parents were like,
I would kill you.
And think like a sixth, seventh, eighth grader, like hopped up on sugar being like,
That's
so
crazy.
When I went to high school, I mean, also like when it came to music, I always just kind of heard the bass line. Like it always kind of had a more forward sound to me in the songs. So one day I left high school, you know, freshman year of high school, I went to Guitar Center and I got a PV, you know, a crappy $100-$150 PV bass. And I was like, and I just started futzing around with it and just kind of became something I like to do. And I think I could never read sheet music, but I could always hear it and replicate it.
Yeah.
So being able to do that helped me with my musicality going forward in the lighting career, starting in theater where I started, but ultimately carrying over to concert touring. And
I mean, you know, I think bass and drums, like I've known a lot of LDs who were either part-time for fun drummers or were drummers before they became LDs or whatever. And I think, you know, obviously being part of the rhythm section really, you know, obviously gives you some better timing and stuff. And I think it fits, you know, like you like that sort of changing thing. And like you said, sort of forward. I mean, but I fell into it. I mean, he literally fired the guy and handed me a bass guitar and said, learn to play it. And, you know, later on in life, like today, I probably own 2 bass guitars, maybe 3 bass guitars, I can't remember, and about 10 guitars. And nice. So if I ever pick up something to just goof around, it's usually an electric guitar, sometimes an acoustic guitar.
Well, it's It's always hard, like, to pick up a, like, I have a trainer base cab in my office, which is
Oh,
probably the
wow.
worst place. It's 218s.
Yeah, I
But
have a Trainer
it's
218 base cabinet.
oh,
Like
do you really?
boom, boom, boom,
Oh my God.
boomy.
And I have a Schecter five string, and that
Oh,
low
nice.
B, oh my God, when you hit that, it rattles. Like,
Yeah,
my
those
neighbors are
pictures
like,
fall off the
huh?
wall behind you. Yeah.
But I mean, it's you hit it on the head. It's kind of like I feel like to be a good concert lighting this or just lighting designer that's dealing with music, to have a rhythm section, a background is going to
That's
just
helpful.
serve you.
Yeah.
It's going to serve you so much.
Yeah.
I think that's why I'm so good at. I feel like I'm very good at busking shows
Yeah.
because I know I can follow the drummer and I know where the song is going to go. It's just a feeling that I have.
So, you know, I know this is a really stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So I always see these busking competitions and stuff at LDI, but what is busking a show? Because I mean, I know what a busker is, a street performer or whatever. So is busking basically just walking up and doing lights?
Well, I mean, it's you don't have anything programmed. I mean, you have your
Yeah.
punt page programmed. I mean, Emily, in your podcast with her, she talks about when she does, shows, she's
Yeah.
playing the lights, like, and that's exactly what you're doing. You're
Yeah.
playing the lights like a member of the band, except you don't have anything programmed. You're just when you push a button, it's gonna strobe. When you move that fader up, it's gonna do something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of just
It's kind of like jamming.
what, yeah, I mean, that's basically what it is. It's just a
Yeah.
freestyle form. And, honestly, like when I first started with the cult, that was all it was. It was, you don't have a lighting rig. You can bring a console if you want, but you're not gonna have time to program anything. We're not going to production rehearsals. We're just hitting the road. We're going.
And you're using
And
house
I just
lights
set up.
wherever you go.
Yeah, and then depending on where the venue is, if they don't have anything, we would advance a light plot, something basic. But yeah, it would literally be rolling up in the entire day. On my first tour with the Cult, I was just every day building up and building up more my punt file. So by the end of it, I just had everything accessible to me, and knowing the music at that point. I mean, again, being a musician, I can pick up music really quickly. So if I hear a song two or three times, I know the structure, I know where fills are going, I know
Yeah.
the direction it's going. And then I find it becomes a little more cohesive. So I know that, this song is gonna be blue and gold with some white accent hits, and I'll start to be able to replicate that. So
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So going backwards here a little bit, back to NAMM. Did you do training at NAMM? 'Cause I know you do a bunch of hog training, right?
Yeah, no, at NAMM they didn't have, I don't think they had any console training. They might have had ACT might have had some MA,
Yeah.
but honestly, this year I was really kind of disappointed at NAMM. Not at NAMM, but it just there weren't a lot of vendors that we had in previous years. And I get it, ISE is going on. We
Yeah.
just had LDI.
Yeah.
But like the idea of NAMM as a kind of crossroads, it kind of sets it up that it would be a perfect show for our industry because you have your artists doing endorsement deals, your tour managers are there, your production managers are there. So, instead of sending them a YouTube clip or like a website to go check out about a new product you might want to use on a tour, why not take them over to the booth, show them the fixture, you have
It's
a
a good
vendor.
thought. It's a nice
Yeah, I
thought,
mean,
but in reality, like, you know, it's just not the core audience. And so it's funny because I talked about this on the intro. NAMM, I've been literally doing booths at the NAMM show since 1992. And that was
sure.
when I was early with Martin's distributor Trakimin. And you know, I remember we used to be in the exit of the convention center that faced towards the right towards the Hilton Lounge. And this was back in the day when the Hilton Lounge was like manic. You know, it was just complete mayhem in there as soon as the show ended. And But so, you know, we were right by the exit. And I remember one day Eddie Van Halen walking in and coming to our booth and going, whoa, this stuff's pretty cool. And I mean, this is like 1993 or something, right? And he's like, this stuff's pretty cool. What's going on here? And, you know, I'm like, ah, ca, ca, ca. You know, it's Eddie Van Halen. And he's asking me questions about lights. What do I do? And had a 15 minute conversation with Eddie Van Halen about moving lights, right? It was so cool. But what we always counted on was like the music store from the Midwest somewhere who just tripped over your booth and went, oh, I've been meaning to get into lighting, you know. But like the way I described it on the intro, I don't know what the attendance was this year, but I mean, I think it's usually around 100,000 people at NAMM or whatever over the 4 days.
100 to 200,000. I mean, but the thing is, they come from all over the world. But, like, you get people from Africa there, from, you know, Eastern Europe, and it's you know, you get House of Worship people, you have your DJ people. I think 2019 or 2020, right before we got locked down, we had a NAMM show, and it was because it's in January.
Yeah.
And I want to say that was, I think, the biggest showing. Like, we had, you know, Chevet was kind of always there. They weren't there this year. But Elation had a pretty big booth, American DJ, you know, SGM, GLP. They were all there. And Four Wall was actually there doing their used lighting thing.
Yeah.
And they had a good amount of sales from what I was told. Mm-hmm. They actually gave like a 10%, you know, discount so they could track their sales and see if it was worth it. Yeah. And, you know, they said in a week, you know, DJs coming up wanting to buy like, you know, LED PARs or, you know, they ended up doing really, really well. And then the pandemic hit. And then that just kind of, I think any forward momentum that we got coming up that way kind of just.
Yeah, but here's the problem. So, you know, let's imagine, you know, I don't know what some really expensive shopping would be in New York, but like the equivalent of, what is it, Madison Avenue or something like that, you know?
Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, something like that. So imagine putting a store there on Fifth Avenue where you know that only about 3% or 2% of the traffic walking by is even remotely interested in your product, because you're a bit of a strange product for that industry or that market or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. That's what NAMM is to lighting companies. You know, it's not their core audience. About 95% of the people coming to that show have no interest whatsoever in lighting. So you're spending big money, the same money that a guitar company or an amplifier company or a drum company would be spending for the 95% audience. You're spending for the 5% audience. And so it's not always the greatest value. Like, you're just looking for that accidental deal that trips over you or whatever. But, you know, I talked to several manufacturers. They said it was busy, but it was like me. You know, it wasn't incredible from a business standpoint or anything.
I just see, like, there's just some energy to NAMM that, like, I like LDI, don't get me wrong. One of the things I like about LDI is just seeing all my friends who I haven't seen in a year. And unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to go to a lot of LDIs in recent years or in past years because the time. It's always right in the middle of touring. And you know, it's weird because everyone goes, the audience is actually coming to NAMM. They're just coming for the Parnellis.
Yeah.
Like, if you knew the industry, that the amount of people in our industry that were in that room, like, okay, like, why not set it up, make the investment, and really push to make it worthwhile to have, you know, Rob Koenig was like, the Metallica production team was there. People would love to sell product to those guys.
Yeah.
You know, you had young aspiring talent there that would love to get their hands on some of this stuff. And really the only representation was SGM had a booth, GLP had a booth, ADJ had a booth, and everything else was like Chinese knockoff.
Well, which was... Yeah, but let me put it to you this way, Matt. So a booth the size of an ACT or a Roby at LDI. Oh, let's talk about LDI.
ACT was actually there too. Yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about LDI, a booth the size of Robey or ACT. They're spending almost $1 million on that booth. And so that's not something that you can do lots and lots of times. Generally, you're not going to make back anywhere near your investment on orders that you get at that show. So you're really investing in the year of business, not just in that show of business. And, you know, NAMM, probably for me, the first few years we did it, it worked out pretty well because we were one of very few lighting companies there. And like I said, the old music store from the Midwest somewhere was tripping over us and going, yeah, I want some of that stuff in my store. I want to sell some club lights or whatever, right? Yeah. And this was early in the industry. And now, though, you know, everyone has access to these products. Those companies are not really there to meet with lighting companies. They're there to meet with their top guitar vendors or whatever vendor. So I don't know, like I wish it would work because it should, you know, and, but it's just such a big investment and it's right after LDI and I don't know if it'll ever work, but, I wish it would because I love the NAMM show. I went to a whole bunch of NAMM shows as a music vendor. Before I ever did it as a lighting company. And then I did it for 10 years as a lighting company too. So,
No, it's just, I like the energy. I like seeing the people that I wouldn't normally see, you know, walking by a giant drum circle. That's pretty cool.
That's very cool.
I like the sense of community. And
I
totally hear what you're saying.
Yeah. I'll go back to the Wayback Machine. So when I first started going as a music company, I was, this is well before you were born, I think. So this was like the early to mid 80s was the first time I went to the NAMM show. Probably 83, 82 was my first NAMM show. And
I was one.
Yeah, there you go. So I remember there would be times when I'd be standing at the bank of payphones talking to my girlfriend and I'd be like, whoa, there's, you know, Joe Satriani. Whoa, there's Eddie Van Halen. Whoa, there's so-and-so, whoever, right? And it was just all mini skirts and rock stars. It was such a fun show. And then party at the Hilton Lounge across the street afterwards. And and then, you know, you'd go out to local clubs and see, you know, just the craziest huge bands playing at these clubs. Or they'd have these throw-togethers where it's, you know, Van Halen and Seymour Duncan and Leslie West from Mountain and like just all these people that are jamming, you know, and you're just like, wow, this is so cool to experience this.
Yeah.
It was fun.
I mean, it is cool. It is cool because I did get to see some people that I tour with, you know, the audio guys, some musicians. So it was, you know,
it's a cool show.
I got my 2 days of awesome and Parnelli love.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. That's awesome. Hopefully you'll be on the Parnelli list soon. So keep working hard, young feller.
Thanks, Dad.
Speaking of being young, you're part of a younger generation who, you know, I always talk about on this podcast how people got into the business and the fact that it's usually just a real weird lucky thing where you're sitting at a pub and some guy next to you, you know, works for some big band or something and says, hey, you want a job? I need a guy to do this or whatever, right? And next thing you know, you're a touring guy and you've made a 40-year career out of it. But you're part of a younger generation who was actually able to study lighting design. And I think you did that at Boston University, right?
Yep. I went there for theater. Yeah. I was there 1999 to 2003. It was great. The best way to describe it is this industry found me because I didn't get into this until high school where, I was looking for something. I went to a new high school. I wanted to do something different. So I joined the football team. Right. So we played and then after football was done, I was like, what am I going to do with myself? I'm just bored. So, I walked by one day, saw a poster for Dracula that my school was doing, and I went to go see it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Cause it was a school where they actually invested in the arts still and, joined the stage crew and just started building sets, painting sets. And, then I had the option in my junior and senior year to start taking, more classes basically. So I took, costume design, masks and makeup, scenic design, lighting design, and I just kind of stuck. I just really was like getting a an inkling for lighting. I was passionate about it. We were getting ready to do a festival where we were having a bunch of schools come and compete, and the lighting designer for the school at the time got sick, and my teacher was like, "Well, you're up."
Oh,
So
wow.
basically, I got bumped into that, got put in a high pressure situation, knocked it out of the park, and then at that point, I was like, "This is really what I want to do." So at that point, I was applying to colleges, didn't really know what I wanted to do in college, and then at that point, I was like, "I want to go for lighting design." So applied to BU, BC, Holy Cross, mostly like Northeast schools, got into BU, and that was the best thing that could have happened to me. I got in at a school that had a major regional theater where we were getting Broadway lighting designers coming in and designing shows. I got to assist them. I got to watch them in their process. I got to focus lights for them, which was, it's just, it's amazing. Fast forward, graduated college, and then just immediately hit the ground running. Started like sending resumes. I mean, I really didn't have much of a resume. I had my college stuff and some stuff I was doing over the summer, but just sent my resume out and was like begging people to hire me. Eventually, I got calls and I worked on shows and I built up a resume and my name got out there. But one thing I will say about theater is that it just doesn't pay well. Like you would spend 3 months on a show and get $500. Like that's just the way it is. And if there's one good thing the pandemic taught us is knowing your self-worth, right? Knowing what you're worth and what a living wage is. Well, we didn't do that. Like I would go from one gig, open a show, get in my car, pound a Red Bull, drive 4 hours to Vermont to design another show that I spent 3 days sleepless teching a show, then drive home, have one day off, do my laundry, go someplace. It was just, at one point I was doing 35, almost 35, 40 shows a year, which is basically I was in tech almost every week of that year.
And
It's
making
just
no
not,
money.
it's not, and making enough to survive, to pay your rent, put gas in the car, and eat. I mean,
Why though? Why
that's basically it.
do you have to leave theater and go to corporate or rock and roll to make any money?
Well, it's the so if you look at it, right? So if you look at let's look at conservatory, right? Let's say a B or A lister lighting director is making somewhere between $3,000 to $5,000 a week, right? That's a week. You would, if you were lucky, doing a major regional theater and spending at this point, like the rates have changed obviously with inflation, but at this point, like if you're going to do a Broadway show or a Lort B, you're going to probably be making $4,000 to $5,000 for the show. And that's about, anywhere from 4 to 6 month commitment with production meetings, reading scripts, drafting your light plots, talking to shops. It's just it.
That's
And
crazy.
ultimately, what you're doing, it's crazy. Ultimately, like you would hope that you have multiple ones going on at the same time. So like you have your meeting and then you're going into tech, and it layers out that way. But when you're only making $500, trust me, I would like go to New York City to work on an off Broadway show just to get an off Broadway show credit where I'm getting $250 because that's all the producer
But
had to pay me.
is that because of the economics of a theater show? Like is or did someone just, did you just get shoved down the line to where, everybody gets paid before the tech crew?
No, I think it's, I mean, even actors, you look at actors, they don't get paid nearly what they're worth. I mean, that's why these summer stock theaters, these kids are making, maybe 150, 200 bucks a week, but they're getting housing provided and they're getting to do their art. That's kind of the selling point, right? But I mean, it's not, listen, I love theater, and I'm actually getting ready to do a theater show in about a month. I'm doing Beautiful, the Carole King musical, because I can, you know, coming from a theater background, it allowed me to kind of train my eyes to be able to work in multiple disciplinary things within lighting. Yeah. So like I could do concert touring, I could do corporate, I can do fashion, I can do, you know, my skill set is such that I'm not just, I came up into this industry being educated. So I think that really helped me to be able to diversify my strengths within lighting.
That's important.
So it's not, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's different. You get some kids now, they're coming in, you know, they go to school, they get like a basic tech theater education. And, you know, a lot of things that are, a lot of companies like cruise ships are really hunting to find people. So they're getting these young kids in and kind of shaping them in a certain way. Same thing goes with shops. You know, you get these kids coming in coiling cables, and then magically they get the opportunity to be like an L3 on on a major tour, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's just the hustle, you know, it's just whatever you need to do to hustle and learn.
So is theater still like, is theater still like your, you know, main love that you'd love to go back to when you have the opportunity? Is it that kind of a thing or is it just another gig?
No, I mean, nothing for me is ever just a gig.
Yeah.
Even when it comes down to corporate, because I care too much, even if my name is like, nobody's going to know who designed this. Yeah. I just care too much. Like to just be it's fine.
I don't think you can care too much. You know, I think it's a good thing. And that's what keeps you getting hired is when you care and people know that you give a shit. Right.
Yeah. Well, I would hope so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, for me, whenever I came, like there was a good chunk of time that I didn't do theater because I was just focused. I was like the concert touring stuff is just coming in. You know, I was, you know, 2018, I was lighting director on Evanescence. 2019, I was, you know, got into lighting directing and, you know, Alice in Chains. And then that kind of folded over to where it was kind of a design. It was a very gray, muddy area on that. but it was all this stuff. It just kept coming, you know, phone calls kept coming, opportunities kept coming. And trust me, there were theaters that reached out to me and said, can you do the show? And, you know, I tried to make it work. And it's, you know, I think in the last, you know, 6 years, I've probably done about 6 to 10 theater shows, which I like it. I want to keep doing it. It is a passion of mine, but you know, I still love being in front of house and hearing the go house lights, go for show, the
Such
lights
an
blacking
energy.
Out, the crowd just going insane
and
getting those butterflies in my stomach. Oh, it's one of the best. It's better than drinking. You know, I don't do drugs, but it's better than like that.
Whatever you do, don't say it's better than sex. 'Cause I know you have a girlfriend now and that could cause you some issues. Don't say that.
It's not.
Zip. Yeah. Zip it.
So exactly. No, it's just it's I just love. I just love what we do. You know, it's such a great.
Yeah. No, it's cool. I mean, you know, I've never been an LD who has stood at the console and, you know, called cues and called house lights out or whatever. But I've been standing front of house and been part of that. And it's even exciting for me watching, you know, and praying that whatever lights that I sold to that production work, you know, they come on when he calls that cue or whatever. Right.
Oh, absolutely.
So your first tour, I think tours that you did were actually theater tours, not rock and roll tours, right?
Yeah. My first tour was, I was the lighting designer for the Moscow Ballet.
Oh, wow.
Which was kind of an amazing experience. I worked at as a house LD at, some people on your podcast would know, South Shore Music Circus in up in Boston, just South Shore. I was also the house LD at Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom, a couple of venues in Boston, and one of the production managers of South Shore Music Circus. It's a summer venue, so in the winter nobody's working. So
right.
He got a job, at with this company in Western Mass that are producers for the Moscow Ballet. And he said, "Hey, you're a great LD. Do you want to come out and do this?" And I was like, "Hell yeah, I do."
That's
so
cool.
That was kind of a baptism by fire. I was basically on the road from end of September through New Year's. And we were touring two different shows. We were doing Sleeping Beauty and the Nutcracker. And we went everywhere from Regina to
Rhymes with Fun.
Yeah. I mean, and it was like a rock and roll tour. We never did a sit down. It was, you know, 6 a.m. load-ins, you know, two show days sometimes, pack it all up into the truck, move on. So trust me, I definitely learned, you know, I cut my teeth in touring that way.
Did you tour on buses at that time though?
Yeah. Funny story. Our tour bus on the Moscow Ballet tour was the Hanson Mbop tour bus in their music
no
video
way.
That
That's
they're
hilarious.
shooting the water guns out of the windows. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
So let me ask you, cause I'm really curious and it's another stupid Marcel question, but, living on a tour bus for a ballet, different than living on a tour bus for the Cult?
Well, so not really. Like, we still have our crew members. We had, you know, we had a stage manager, lighting, sound, merch.
I just feel like the people would be so much more cultured, you know, on a ballet tour than a rock and roll tour. Like less drugs, less nonsense, less, you know, of all the bad stuff.
I mean, I think the worst we did was smoke pot. Like, and we would drink. Like, but it wasn't like, I don't think we really had time to party our face off. Like, I mean, you want to talk about grueling. I think we had maybe 4 days off that entire run. Ooh, one of them was Jesus. Thanksgiving. One of them was Christmas. But we did actually, we had a great time. We convinced our production manager to route our bus to Key West for Christmas. Oh, we parked up in an RV slot and basically for Christmas dinner, we caught fish and grilled them on the beach. It was
no
pretty
way.
Amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is
pretty,
awesome.
Pretty cool.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, a roadie is a roadie, even if they're theater roadies, you know.
I know.
It was fine.
Stupid Marcel question, but I just wanted to ask. Well, you know, I've always been intrigued by the idea of a tour bus, you know, with 8 of your closest friends in bunks and stuff, you know, but because I've never done it. Like, I've toured with bands as a band member, but we never had I never made it to the point of a tour bus. We were in like a school bus with the gear in the back and the people in the front. And, you know, you either slept on speaker cabinets in the back or you slept on a seat in the front. And that was about, you know, as fancy as touring got for me. But so that first tour, did you go, "Oh yeah, this is what I want to do"?
Yeah, because I liked the waking up in a different city, but it was the same task. You know what I mean? It's like, we got to do the same thing. We got to achieve the same goal, but it's a different four walls every day. You're dealing with a different crew.
Yeah.
So at a very young age, I got a temperament for being able to work with stagehands. And, you know, when you're walking into, you know, local 2, local 3, local 1 here, as a young kid, and you're the head electrician / lighting designer, and you're talking to these guys that have 40 years on you and are, you know, gruff, you learn how to play, you know, the rules, you know, when to push, and you know, when to, you know, what hill to die on, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You learn that really quick.
That's a good point.
So I think at a young age, like being able to do that was, you know, I think I started when I was doing that, it was, I want to say it was like 26, 27. So I didn't start touring like, as a kid. But I did learn, you know, baptism by fire. Like I didn't have that shop work. I didn't have that experience. Like I'd always wanted to go concert touring. Like I would go see like Dave Matthews Band concerts. Like they were my like Grateful Dead when I was a kid, right? So I would go to like 200 shows, and I'd always be like, oh man, this lighting is so cool. I would love to do this.
And, you know who my Grateful Dead was? Grateful Dead.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm old. No, I was never a Grateful Dead guy. I was never a weed guy, so I didn't get the Grateful Dead. You know, it just didn't, like, I loved Supertramp. I loved more, I don't know, just, I loved bands that I thought were good musicians and stuff and made a really nice polished sound and stuff. I didn't like jam bands. I'd never been a Dave Matthews fan, was never really a Black Crowes fan, was never really a Counting Crows fan. Like, all these jam bands just never really did anything for me.
And that's the beauty of it. Like, yeah, you don't need to like everything that's out there.
That's why there's lots of different stuff. So you've toured. What was your first rock and roll tour?
Okay, so it was Neon Trees back in 2011, 2012.
Oh, so really recent.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, ish. I would say recent-ish. Yeah, I mean, 10 years. Yeah. I mean, it was working at Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom, working at, you know, all these other places, being where I mastered my punting craft.
Yeah.
Bands would be like, oh wow, those lights were actually, it's like we're carrying our own lighting person. Give me your card. So I handed out cards left, right, and center. And one friend of mine basically said, this band's looking for an LD. Are you interested? Like, you know, they're coming to Boston in 4 days. Can you meet them at Paradise and, you know, see if it's a good fit? Went there, talked to the lead singer, talked to a couple of the members of the band, walked around with the production manager, just kind of trying to, you know, he's feeling me out as production managers do. Mm-hmm. And, the next morning I got a phone call saying, you know, we want to replace this guy. We want you in. Can you be in Norfolk at the Norva in 2 days?
And I was who'd you replace?
Okay.
You don't have to tell me if you don't want to. All right.
I can't say that.
Good.
It was just, you know, he was an older gentleman. This was a younger band. And their just aesthetics didn't clash. They clashed. They didn't meld and blend together. So, you know, having somebody, you know, within their age range that has an aesthetic that could really push things. The challenge to that was, you know, back then we didn't have Previs. You know, Previs is a relatively new thing. So, and he was on a AVO, I want to say, and I'm by no means like the killer AVO guy. And I was like, can I get my own console? And at that time, Hog 3 was still out there. Hog 4 had not existed yet. So I got myself a Hog 3 and literally day one set up the floor package the way I wanted the floor package to be set up. It wasn't prepped properly, so I had to reprep it. And then I just sat down and started programming. And I probably got through 5 songs. And then the rest of the show, I just punted. And then each day I would set up, program a little bit more, you know, punt what I didn't have and just kind of built the show as I went. And unfortunately that was a reoccurring theme for me. A lot of my friends called me the doctor because several bands, you know, in this time period, would call me to fix shows. You know, they hired a young kid who didn't know what they were doing or whatever. So I would be brought in and I'd have to redesign the show from scratch. So I got really good at that.
Yeah.
Previs, just going in there and slamming.
That's a good thing though. So, that's a really good thing. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, guys like Cosmo have done so great at just being adaptable and, you know, like Cosmo, when he first came on my podcast, he said, you know, I just say yes. And then I figure it out. I say yes to everything and I figure it out, you know, and that's, it's a good attitude to have. And this fix it doctor guy is also a really good thing. You know, I think it's good to become known as a guy who can come in and solve some problems and fix some stuff and make you happy, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, and even if it's, you know, you would hope it would be a long-term thing. Like you come in, you fix it, they're happy with it. You know, I remember the first night, another band I worked for, Mr. Wives, I met them at Boston Calling and, you know, 4 days later they were like, hey, are you available? And, we'd like you to come out and replace this, you know, this person. He's just young. He didn't, he didn't prep any of his limbs. Everything was loose cable. So when you would open up the trunk, you would be just like a stinger. And you're just like, what is going on here?
Oh my goodness.
So the load-ins would take 8 hours, and it was not good. The first night that I did the show, like, I'm, you know, you take your shower, you're getting on the bus, getting ready to roll. And the guitar player, like, he knew I was there because I was above him. And he just flew open the curtain of the bunk. And he was like, this photo is amazing. You make me look like a god. And I was like, that's the best compliment you could get, right?
Oh, there you
know,
you go.
That there's in one night, one show that, you know, they're happy with it.
That's cool.
So, and you hope that relationship continues and you get to keep working with those bands.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. No, that's really cool. And I mean, you did some cool stuff. Maroon 5, Evanescence.
I was lighting director on Maroon 5. That was a Dempus design. Way back in the day. That was the first time I got to meet and work with Joe Cabrera. That was an amazing experience. I had to learn MA for that, so I knew just enough MA to be dangerous.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Wow, I forgot about Dempus.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a sad one.
Yep. Absolutely.
So, how'd you get into the Cult? How'd that happen?
So the tour manager for the Cult used to tour manage Alice in Chains, and we were wrapping up the Alice in Chains Rainier Fog tour in 2019, and I'm trying to remember who. I think it was actually like Court Lawrence. Actually, I think recommended. Like he wasn't available. And he reached out to me or put out feelers, and somebody recommended me because they knew my tour was coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And put me in touch with the tour manager. The tour manager had actually, you know, a couple of years earlier stopped tour managing Alice in Chains. So he was like, okay, we have that connection.
Yeah.
And, you know, I took over Alice in Chains from Marty Postma. He was like, I love Marty Postma. So we got that bond going. And then basically we would talk on the phone, and it was a European tour, and they were ultimately looking for a UK tour. Ultimately, they were trying to find a UK designer so they didn't have to pay for flights.
Right.
Because it was a small tour. It's only like 2.5 weeks. And he was like, so after about like, I want to say 5 phone conversations, he was like, what's preventing me from hiring you? And I was like, a plane ticket. And he was like, you're in. All right, we're getting you a flight, and we'll see you in 3 weeks.
That's hilarious.
I mean, it's, you know, it's sometimes you got to work for it. But
when was that? What year was that?
2019. So the fall of 2019.
Oh, you've been with the Cult for a long time then, for 4 or 5 years.
Well, I mean, we did have that
three-year
pause.
But... Yeah. Yeah, but you came right back with them after it, right? They didn't find somebody during COVID to bump you.
Yeah, no.
So that's good.
I mean, the thing is, I really, in that camp, like, it's, you know, there are different dynamics, right? And there are a lot of people who are listening to this podcast that have probably worked with that band and know the dynamics within that band. But there's something about, like, yes, it can get stressful. Yes, it can get confusing because one person is saying one thing and another person is saying another. But the thing that I've always discovered with that band is there's just something about when they're playing and when you're doing your show. I have never had more fun in my life lighting a band than lighting the Cult. There's something about it. They're that old school rock band that doesn't play the tracks. And while they might flub a note here or there every once in a while, especially after the pandemic, they are playing and they sound like 30 years ago. It's like, it's absolutely amazing. And the energy that they give on stage every night is just, it's just amazing.
So when you talk about a dynamic, is that like Ian Astbury and what's the other guy's name? Like they don't get along well or something?
No, they do. It's just, you know, Ian has, the thing that I like about Ian is he is an artist.
Yeah.
Like through and through. Like we will get into deep conversations about, you know, design concepts. Like his big influences are like Nine Inch Nails and Bauhaus, right?
Yeah.
So he keeps sending me, so we're on a tour where we have this big sepia backdrop that's a mountain and it has the Sonic Temple logo on it, mm-hmm. right? And he keeps sending me these Bauhaus Nine Inch Nail photos and says, I want my show to look like that. And I said, okay. What is the overarching theme that you're seeing in all of these photos that's really that you want? And he goes, you clearly have the answer to this. Why don't you just tell me? And I said, negative space. There's darkness, there's black, there's like an infinitesimal amount of space back there, and it just goes. Meanwhile, we have a backdrop that even when you completely black out the stage, you could still see it. So, that at least got us into a conversation where I could production design, and we then started getting we got rid of that backdrop, and we brought in this we went to rent I went to Rent What and got this amazing backdrop. It was called Black Camo Chaos, and it looks like an old Austrian drape. And it's made out of tank camo netting, and it's painted in
Oh,
pewters and
cool.
blacks and grays, and it's all swagged, so it looks very gothic. But when you turn the lights off or you don't light it, it completely goes away. So you just have this infinite blackness back there. And from that moment, we were able to really start crafting a design for this band that I wasn't competing with this sepia-toned backdrop that really didn't, to me, didn't really speak to what this band was anymore. I feel like they've evolved into like going, they're technically a goth band, right? Goth rock or whatever. But I still see them as like they're, especially like the hits that they play doesn't seem very gothy to me. Like Fire Woman, She Sells Sanctuary. That stuff is, to me, that's rock and roll. That's like 80s rock, 80s, 90s rock, But what we just did, this 40th anniversary of Death Cult, where it was all the Dreamtime record, where it's like 83rd Dream, Dreamtime, Christians, like all that stuff. That is that the sound, that like new wave, post-punk goth sound. That like when they say they're goth, I'm like, yes, that is 100% goth. And we were able to really achieve some cool stuff on this last
So
tour.
let me ask
So
you, because I was, I was a minor cult fan, I would say, but I didn't know about this death cult thing. And when I first saw you going out to tour with Death Cult, I'm like, is this the same band or what is it? And so I Googled it, and so they were, that was the original version of the cult, right? Was called
yes.
Death
Well, there
Cult.
was Southern. Yeah, it was Southern Death Cult was, or yeah, Southern Death Cult was the first iteration, and then some members fell off. I believe that was Ian's original band. Then Billy came in, and then they created, they basically dropped the Southern and just named it Death Cult, and that's kind of like where they found their sound. And they did one album, which was this Death Cult stuff, and then basically they dropped to the death and just became the cult after that. So it's just a growth process. Like us as artists, as me as a designer, as an artist, like you grow, you develop, you rebrand. That's kind of what they did.
So when they went out and toured as Death Cult, did they just play that one album?
Pretty much, they basically played that album. They played She Sells Sanctuary, Rain. They basically said they weren't going to play anything past Rain, the Rain, where the album that Rain is on. And then they played they had Spirit Walker, I think was another song that they played on there. But I mean, it was like 17 or 18 songs. I mean, it was a pretty, I mean, also those songs, some of them are shorter than others. So the set, while if you're doing, Fire Woman or, any of the older songs that are definitely like 5 to 6 minutes long, these songs, some of them are like 2 or 3 minutes long. So, the set times kind of truncate themselves. But, I mean,
But
it's
is it
fine.
basically just the same fans? Like they just go, oh, the cult is back again, and this time they're back as the death cult, and so I'm just going to get
It's,
tickets again, right?
yeah, I mean, that's the thing. These, the thing is, this is the first time this band has played these songs in 40, 39, 38 to
That's
40 years,
cool,
something like that, give or take. So the nostalgia of these people coming to, and the band made an effort to play smaller rooms. They wanted to play rooms that they played back then.
Oh, I see.
So,
That's
we
cool.
were in, yeah, so like
But
we
in a sense,
played,
it's kind of like Kiss saying, we're going to do just the Destroyer album or whatever, right? And
Exactly,
going and touring,
exactly,
which a
exactly.
lot of sort of classic rock bands are starting to do now. Like I just saw one the other day who's going, an 80s band, who was it? He's touring Rat with, and they're doing the entire Out of the Cellar album.
Oh, and that's cool.
Sebastian Bach is doing it too. He's doing the first Skid Row album, I forget what it's called. I was never a huge fan, but yeah, so that's cool. So, but I mean, was it the same design, or did you actually change up the design too?
So the challenge for that show was in October, we went out to do a West Coast run with just straight up Cult. But in the middle of that, we did a show at the Ace Hotel in LA. That was Death Cult. We were doing one night in LA, this Death Cult show. And I had to basically start programming these songs with the existing Cult rig. And then when I went to the UK, I adapted it. So one of the cool things about Ian is he's like, he wants it to be as hazy as a cemetery on stage. He told me that. He's like, I want it to be dark. I don't want front light. So that's a challenge to let the audience be able to see them without pissing off, you know, the talent.
I saw pictures. I just thought maybe you were a shitty designer or something. I could never see the band. No, I'm kidding.
You can actually see them. The crazy thing is you actually could see them. My front light color choices were always really important. They were not overly saturated, but like it was a blue with, a little paler blue than I would use in a fully saturated blue.
Yeah.
And it would be enough for them to feel comfortable on stage. The other thing is he loves strobes. So I had to, in my initial Cult design, I had 8 JDC ones on this. I added 4 more. I added a bunch more mega points on towers. You know, I kept the core of what I had in my programming, but I just beefed it up, and I cut. I think I had some Tetra 1s that, unfortunately, the vendor didn't have, so I just cut them. The Tetra 1s were, like, lighting the back line, and we didn't need to do that for this. So,
that's cool. And a Hog 4, of course.
All on a Hog 4. I actually, I brought my Fly Rig console, which I built, which is great. You know, it fits in a 1637 Pelican, and I can fly anywhere in the world with it. It is 64 universes, more than a MA3 full size.
Wow. Have you never had any pressure to like learn an MA console, or do you know an MA console well enough to run a show? Or
I could run a show, but I can't program a show on it.
Yeah.
And my whole thing is I'd rather be really good at one thing than just okay at others.
Yeah.
I picked up learning Hog in college. We got an amazing capital improvement grant when I was in college, and my first moving lights console was a Hog 500. So basically, that's what I learned on. So I felt really comfortable, like the 20 plus years, that's what I felt comfortable on. Obviously, a Hog 500 is a huge, huge leaps and bounds to, you know, a Hog 4 right now, but it's just what I feel comfortable with. I can program just as good of a show as anyone on an MA.
Yeah.
It's not a Hog 3, and I'm sure the MA family of people would loved that the Hog 3 happened, because they did get the lion's share of Hog 3 programmers moving over to the MA.
They lost their market really quickly on the Hog 3. You know, because the Hog 2 owned the market. I mean, like, literally 98% of the console market was Hog 2. And then Hog 3 happened, and it kind of went, let's create like these fingers of lots of different stuff out there, you know, because the Hog 3,
well, you know,
had some issues.
You know, I will say, just to any manufacturer listening here, don't ever put a 3 in the name of your product. There's the Mac 3, the Hog 3.
Yeah. Yeah, and other 3s, yeah.
Another 3.
How many enemies you want to make on one podcast? We got to be careful.
I'm not. Yeah. It's all about the love. No, I mean, honestly, we can all razz each other. I get so much crap for being a hog guy, but you know, there's plenty of work, and I like being known as one of the guys
Well,
to be
and
able to come in and do it. So
it's also nice to be important to your vendor. You know what I mean? Like you can call ETC and say, hey, here's some things that I'd like to see changed. Or, you know, I'm sure they're probably going to talk to you when they're creating the Hog 5, if they probably already are creating the Hog 5. But, you know, I'm sure they're going to talk to you because you've been one of their most loyal users, you know, still to this day.
I mean, There are more of us out there. I'm just
going to
let you know. But.
No. I mean, we sell used Hog 4s as fast as we get them. So I know there's lots of happy users of Hog 4s. But yeah, I mean, I just wonder, like, as a guy in New York who's, you know, looking to put food on the table and stuff, are you forced to at some point learn the MA2, MA3, MA whatever? And it doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, I mean, I survived a global pandemic living in New York City, and I somehow found a way, barely.
Yeah,
somehow,
all of us,
Somehow found a way to pay my rent. So,
yeah. I mean, I wanted to talk about that because I every once in a while I go back and watch some of the Zoom calls that I recorded. I didn't record them all, but I recorded some of them. And
I saw one of your ones that you posted on Instagram, on the Geezer's Instagram, and it's just it's zoomed in on like four of us. It's Marcia Stern and me up at the top, and I just am like,
yeah.
Like,
well,
can
I
we
think
get
that's,
out of this?
And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that how we met, like on those Zoom calls? Like, I don't think I knew you before that, and
no, I didn't know you.
We got to know each
and
other pretty
say,
well and became friends.
Yeah, and I wanted to say thank you so very much for doing those, because it was such a, I looked forward to those every week. Like that was like my touch with reality.
Yeah, you know? No, me too. I looked forward to it as well. I mean, a lot of us, you know, we were sort of going through detox or, you know, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it was just like, you know, everything's gone. Like, you know, my whole life is gone. All my friends are gone. What do I do? I mean, you could still talk to your friends, but it just wasn't the same.
Sure.
But, you know, where that whole idea came from was I owned a franchise company as well, and it was actually had just wound down, but I still knew a lot of people in the franchise business. And one of my franchise friends said, I was just on a Zoom happy hour. And I said, what's a Zoom happy hour? And they said, oh yeah, everybody just goes on there and drinks. And I said, well, geez, I got to do a Zoom happy hour for my industry, because everyone loves to drink in my industry, and nobody's got anything to do right now. We're completely shut down. And so it just started as that, you know. It was just like, hey, I threw it out there and see if anybody shows up. And I think the first week, like 10 or 15 people showed up, and the next week it was 20, and the next week it was 25. And
I mean, we had up to 100 at one point.
Yeah,
right?
I think I had over 100 because I had to upgrade Zoom for a bit there and pay for the over 100 one. And, but you know, it some weeks got a little tense because we were also going through an election period, and you know, so not everyone agreed on everything politically, of course, and socially. Like, there were some people who were really into some social topics and some people who were a little bit against them, and it was funny because, you know, some people were more vocal than others on the other side, especially like on the, call it the Trump MAGA side or whatever, and didn't really say much, but I'd get calls from those people after the podcast going, you know, that asshole said blah 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 and rah 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 rah, and I'm like, why don't you just discuss it during the thing? And you know, I guess it was really hard because it was a toxic environment, you know.
Yeah, well, it doesn't help when you start talking politics and you're drinking. So.
Right. And, you know, I remember one time, the most tense it ever got, I was actually at a racetrack, go figure. And
watching your son, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember Greg Jones from Martin goes, so I just want to ask a question. Where's everybody on masking? And
I remember that.
Oh, we shouldn't go there. And then I think it was Koenig who went, why not? And I said, because we promised we'd never talk about politics or anything divisive. And he goes, well, why the fuck should masks be political or divisive? And I went, well, this is exactly why we shouldn't talk about this, right? Let's just stay friendly. Why not? Yeah. And then it got a little bit ugly. And finally, I was like, guys, I'm just going to end the call because I don't want to argue. Like, I don't want to be in this position. I love all of you. And, you know, so and I'm the same today. Like, I'm getting ready to start shutting down Facebook here soon because it's going to start getting the same way again. And I just don't want to be a part of that.
Sometimes a digital detox is a good thing to have.
The other thing that I remembered while I was prepping for this podcast was you were a big part of the We Make Events thing. And, you know, when that idea first started circulating, you raised your hand instantly and said, yep, I'm in, I want to be a part of it. And you became part of that initial sort of exploratory discussion that we had. Yeah.
I got to say, like, especially for our industry, it gave me so much purpose, especially when it's like every day, it's like the same. So what are you going to do? It's like, it was so amazing to be able to get on phone calls with people and plan and
lighting.
Just bring a
lighting,
I mean,
things.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. You know, it was probably the first time in history that, you know, that many lighting people were so excited to work for free, you know? And, but it really was like, I mean, people seeing lighting companies loading up trucks full of lights. I mean, some of these gigs were big, you know, and they were loading up lights and trusses and all kinds of stuff and programming and everything. And they were so happy to do it. It's the proudest I've ever been in my career and the most happy I've ever been to be a part of something. Like, I remember saying to my girlfriend the night that it was going on and I was watching the Christian Jackson live stream thing. I remember saying to my girlfriend, you know, this is definitely a pinch me moment, like something that hopefully we never have to do again, but I'm so happy that I was a part of it, you know?
I mean, the camaraderie, like the people that I met in this industry, like the people that I would probably never meet, you know, that you're friends with, obviously, because you're just so connected, but like Norm Schwab and like all the West Coast light switch people and, you know, just all of those people, you know, coming together and, you know, it was so amazing. I actually still, over here, Marsha gave me these are the Gobos.
Yeah. She gave me some too, but I never got smart enough to frame them. So I'm going to have to do that. That's a great idea. That's a really cool idea. Yeah. She sent me a t-shirt and some Gobos.
Yeah. It's nice to be able to just look at it and remember and like kind of smile, you know, I definitely like, I just remember when we were in New York City and like, you know, Herrick was going around taking photos of like putting the We Make Events logo on the theaters. And then, you know, somebody called us or something and said, the Empire State Building just went red. The Empire State Building. God, it's amazing. And having that Madison Square Garden and just, you know, it was,
I'm getting a little
teary-eyed.
Oh, dude, it was crazy. It was, again, I mean, I was probably up 24 hours at one point and you know, because there was just a lot going on, like coordinating a lot of different people and different things and media and, you know, trying to do this broadcast thing with Christian, and I had no idea what I was doing and thank God he kind of did. And, no, I mean, the coolest thing ever. I wish it would have swung the politicians a little more than it did, but you can talk to people from outside our industry today about that. And they go, oh, you were a part of that. That's really cool. I remember that, you know, I saw so-and-so was red or whatever. So yeah, that was cool. But you were a big part of that. You were right there at the front end of it. So, you know, part of the sort of core four or eight or whatever it was. I don't remember.
I think there were like eight or 10 of us. Yeah. It was like Chris Hassan and a bunch of other
Chris
people.
Chris Hassan, Marsha, Yumi, Cosmo, Brad Nelms, of course, Cosmo, who became the leader of it when I couldn't do it anymore because it was just too much. it was fun. It was fun. It was a great moment. Yeah.
Yeah, we went to war together, brother.
We absolutely did. It was fun. And sometimes we didn't agree on everything, but we found a way to the end of it somehow, you know?
Compromise.
Yeah. Well, that's what this industry's about, right? Getting it done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate you taking some time today, Mr.
Absolutely.
Matt. It's been fun to get you on finally. I thought you were just too young, you know, so I had to wait until you aged a bit. I see a little tiny bit of gray
young,
in your beard.
I'm not that young.
Tiny bit of gray in your beard. And you got a girlfriend now and stuff. So, you know, you're definitely, you've matured, young man.
Yeah, a little bit older, a little bit wiser.
Is she sick of the touring business yet?
It's always a challenge.
Of
like,
course.
But
yeah.
You know, we actually met during the pandemic, and you know, it was, I've never not been truthful about what
yeah.
I do and
yeah.
the extent of my traveling.
Yeah.
I have cut back a little bit on my traveling.
Yeah.
I've been a little more selective on jobs.
Yeah.
Like before we dated, you know, before the pandemic, I would just take whatever I could because
yeah.
why not?
Yeah.
But I miss, you know, I do miss being home, but I also miss being on the road, and it's not because I want to escape anything going on here. I absolutely love being home. I
yeah.
just love lighting.
Well,
I
it's
love
part of your life. It's a big part of your
shows.
Life. Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
what are you going to do?
Just,
it's a big part of your life. And it's amazing when you find somebody who is understanding about it, you know, and can yeah. deal with it. You know, not everyone can. Obviously it's a tough lifestyle to be a part of.
I mean, it's not all roses and unicorns,
of course,
and
yeah.
stuff, you know,
of
it's,
course.
There are days where it's, you know, I'm five hour time difference or,
yeah.
you know, and, you know, getting able to have those conversations, you know, it can be a challenge, but
yeah,
you know, it's,
yeah.
it's all about compromise and trying to make it work.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully we can, you know, keep on trucking
yeah.
down this road.
Well, and having the discipline and, you know, just care to, you know, get up at the right time to make sure you make that call or whatever, like, you know, the windows and to hit those windows
sure.
and stuff. Like, it's hard. I mean, again, especially when you're in
yeah.
Europe and she's probably got a regular good job and, you know, she goes to work. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, well, good luck to you with that. Seems
well,
like you guys are having
that,
fun. I see your pictures. So
yeah, we're trying.
Cool. All right, buddy.
Well, it's good to see you, my friends.
And you as well.
All right. Talk
Stay
to you
safe.
Soon.
All right, buddy.